On this week's show, we speak to the editor of Men's Health. The iconic title celebrates 30 years this November. We also head to a new exhibition in London celebrating the work of Charles M. Schulz, the creator of comic strip Peanuts. And finally, we celebrate the life of China's best-selling author Louis Cha, who passed away in Hong Kong late October. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We have a busy show ahead. Up next, all about the new exhibition on iconic comic strip Peanuts, and we also speak to one of Hong Kong's top columnists about the life of Louis Cha. But we start the show talking about one of the best-selling men's titles there is. With several international outposts, Men's Health certainly has a vast number of fans. And this month, the American edition celebrates 30 years with a special edition with three different covers. Monocle's Stone Edwards caught up with the editor, Richard Dormant.
It's a really exciting time to be working at this brand. The fact that it's made it through 30 years, it's not only survived, but it's still thriving, is excellent. I do feel a bit of responsibility that I'm taking over this gigantic global brand, but I see it really more as an opportunity. You know, I've spent most of my career prior to this, I was at Wired Magazine, and prior to that, I was at Esquire for quite a long time. So I've been thinking a lot about things like manhood and change and a lot of those larger topics that are happening in the world right now. So a brand like Men's Health, which reaches so many men, not just in the United States, but around the world, the fact that I'm able to, and really obligated, to tackle a lot of these issues that are coming up right now and a lot of the exciting opportunities that come with being a man, it's a great honor, and I get to come to work every day. I'm not exactly knowing what I'm going to be doing, but that's the best part about the job.
I think I know that sort of idea of never quite knowing what you expect, but it being good because it keeps you on your toes. Certainly one thing that your readership can enjoy is one of the ways that you've marked this auspicious milestone, which is this sort of looking back at kind of three really inspirational figures themselves when they turned 30. It's a really neat idea, and I think the execution is fantastic. Can you tell us a bit about how you and your team sort of came up with that, why that works so well? It's a neat trick, but it's neat. It goes beyond that as well, doesn't it?
It does. So the cornerstone of the issue is what we're calling the Legends Portfolio. And it's really the men and women who have changed the way we live our lives. Everything about the way that men eat, work out, work in an office or not in an office, interact with their partner or their loved one, parent, everything is different than it was 30 years ago. So who were the agents and engines behind that evolution and that change? In this Legends Portfolio, we identified the 30 people who were behind all of that change, and we're celebrating them. We wanted to put an extra spotlight on three of those figures who really changed very essential things about how we think about issues of fitness and wellness. So the first cover we chose was probably the most obvious, who was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's had just the most remarkable life, both in entertainment and politics and public service. And through it all, he has incorporated fitness and strength and changed the way we think about those words in a very real and lasting way. The second figure that we chose to shine a spotlight on is Magic Johnson, who, you know, I'm 39 years old, so I grew up, you know, for most of my early life, he was, you know, a superstar basketball player. That's all he was. He was the guy that everybody wanted to be. And then suddenly, in the early 90s, he became something else entirely. And he has sort of emerged as this avatar, this representative of not only surviving, but thriving and being a touchstone for so many people when it comes to the way that he has handled and lived with the HIV diagnosis. So we wanted to celebrate him. And our third was perhaps the most unusual because he actually never made it to the age of 30. It was a guy named Pat Tillman, and I'm not sure if your audience in the UK knows who he is, but he was a U.S. Army Ranger who started out as a professional football player here in the United States, but after 9/11, he retired from the NFL and he joined the Army. And he was killed in Iraq during a friendly fire skirmish by the U.S. Army, and it resulted in, you know, there are a lot of There's a lot of confusion about the circumstances under which he died. There remains a sort of public battle over his legacy and what his death means across America. And we really wanted to shine a spotlight on him as a way of looking at how issues like service and sacrifice have really changed over the last 20 years. Because again, here in America, and I believe in Britain as well, I mean, we've really been at war for longer than any other time in our history. And so what has that meant to an entire generation of American men? So between those three covers, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Magic Johnson, and Pat Tumble, we sort of cover the waterfront and focus on three areas of our lives that have really changed a lot. And to your point, we've showed each of them as close to 30 as we could. Arnold and Magic, we got them at 30. For Arnold, it was when the movie Pumping Iron came out. So his whole career was still ahead of him. He was we call him a muscled nobody at that point. For Magic Johnson, he was in the twilight of his superstar career, and he'd yet to receive his diagnosis, and he was still just a superstar NBA player. And Pat Tillman, we could only get him when he was 27 because he never turned 30. And there is a sort of a bitterness to that that we wanted to spotlight, and this idea of lost promise. So again, our covers really bring these issues to life, but there's so much more on the inside as far as we look at how our lives have changed.
Which that's really fascinating to hear the way that you sort of contextualize those. And I just wanted to pick up actually on something about that. And perhaps it's most striking when you're talking about Pat Tillman. And indeed, we do know his story and this question of a legacy that is itself remains divisive, a bit confused. And there's something very interesting around how that's picked over. I just wondered if we look at the bigger picture recently, and we look about, you also reflect on this idea of, you know, in your previous jobs, work from Wired and Esquire and onwards, about talking about what it is to be a man, a sort of more philosophical question, and these questions around masculinity. You know, it's an interesting moment again in that way, isn't it? I suppose there's different questions around how acceptable it is to be yourself, where the boundaries between that and being a responsible citizen come, and all this kind of thing. Are you comfortable stewarding the title into these more, I suppose they are kind of philosophical questions almost. They're certainly sociological or cultural, and they're not just about men's health, they're kind of about society's health. Is this kind of an interesting time to be asking some of these more complex questions?
It's a fascinating time. And to your point, I wouldn't even say it's a philosophical issue. I think it's an existential issue. Mm. You know, my position, and it's sort of been long-standing, is that now is the single greatest time in the history of the world to be born a man or to be a man. And I think in some ways that plays against the conventional wisdom, right? Because I think a lot of people will be like, oh, men are under scrutiny, men are, you know, messing up and all of these things. And all of that is true. But what is also true is that we have never had a better opportunity to define the type of person that we want to be. What kind of work we want to do, what kind of life we want to build for ourselves, who we want to partner with, whether or not we want to have children. For the longest time, these weren't even options for men. It was just something you either did or you sort of relegated yourself to the outskirts of society. That's no longer the case. And with all of these new opportunities comes a lot of confusion. You know, we're making up these rules as we go along. So how do we help men gain clarity amid all this confusion and give them the information and inspiration they need to create the life for themselves that they really want? You know, when I took this job, it was sort of in the heat of the Me Too movement. And there were a lot of folks when I talked to about taking the job who were sort of, they were hesitant for me because they're like, do you really want to be in charge of a man's brand right now? And I just think that made it that much more appealing to me because, again, I think most men really do want to be better and most men really do want to understand what's happening in the world, particularly as it relates to how they're interacting with women. But they don't know how, or maybe they're feeling defensive about it. And what I see is not only an opportunity, but an obligation, is to lead the conversation in a positive, affirmative way. Because there really is no downside to a world where everybody is treated with dignity. There is no downside to a workplace where everyone feels safe and respected. That's good for everybody. So how do we bring men into the conversation in a positive and affirmative way that makes everybody understand that all these conversations are good and that we're building something positive here? And what's more, if we're not part of the people building it, it's going to be built for us. And that's a lose-lose proposition. So I'm really trying to encourage these conversations and for men to be proactive in both their personal relationships and their professional relationships with trying to understand how they can be better at what they're doing.
And just on that point more broadly then, I wonder about this idea of the aspirational side, I suppose, of men's health. Because, again, it's a bit of an old and probably a slightly sort of tedious question that you get asked about, well, hang on, where does the line fall between being aspirational and representing men as men should aspire to be, and also setting targets that are maybe unrealistic? And again, the old canard about, you know, well, you show people with six packs and, you know, people don't, they feel cut off from that, and they can aspire, but it's not sort of a practical thing. Do you sort of reject that notion out of hand and say, look, you know, yeah, it's good to have targets, it's good to have ambitions, it's good to have things that maybe remain tantalizingly out of reach, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't make those depictions, we shouldn't show those representations?
I think the whole six-pack abs thing is a little bit like the way that some women's magazines will do like 25 different ways to drive him crazy in bed. I think there is a certain honor among thieves with our readers that we don't mean six-pack abs all the time in the most literal sense. We mean it as a goal and not a guarantee. We are all sort of working toward being fitter, stronger, faster versions of ourselves. A lot of us aren't genetically equipped to be, you know, to have six-pack abs. And I think most people understand that. But to have a goal in mind that sort of keeps you moving forward is something that I personally find really useful in my own workout routine. But I think for a lot of people is just something that's really motivating. One of the things that we've been really trying to do here at Men's Health since I've taken over is really expand what we mean by health. So yes, there is strength and power and flexibility and mobility and all those sort of core competencies that the magazine has done so well for the last 30 years. But we're also expanding it well beyond what you do in the gym. We're doing a lot on mental health now and how men can really sort of come to understand with and negotiate things like anger, anxiety, and depression. We're looking at things like work-life balance and parenting and sex and relationships so that men can really optimize themselves in these new arrangements. There are these are all the different things that make up a healthy lifestyle, and there's really no reason why a publication called Men's Health can't really own all of those and help our readers in a positive way.
Do you have to try and keep Men's Health apolitical, I suppose, editorially? Are you troubled by that? Because this is an issue that is relevant and it does affect men's health, societal health, in these ways that we've been talking about. The politics and the personalities that we hear from, sometimes more often than we might perhaps like, they shape that as well. How do you sort of deal with that? Is it something that your readers kind of want to escape from in a way on your pages and on your platforms?
I try to keep politics out of the magazine, and not because I don't think our readers care about it and that they're not engaged with it, but it's because politics, at least in America and at least as it's practiced and perceived, is too often an extremely divisive endeavor, and it's a downer, and it's a race to the bottom. I don't want that to be what Men's Health is for people. I want it to be a unifying, inclusive place where people don't feel otherized or they don't feel like they're being challenged in a way that they don't want to be challenged. So I try to keep the sort of retail professional aspects of politics and politicians out of it. What we don't take out of it, though, and that we're very sort of clear on, are values that we believe strongly in. So things like inclusion and diversity and equal dignity to everybody is a very important part of what we stand for with the magazine. I think, unfortunately, things like LGBTQ rights have become political. And that, you know, our position that everyone should be treated with respect and dignity and equal protection under the law, it's unfortunate that that becomes political in the vein of LGBTQ rights, but that's just kind of the way it is. It's the same thing with access to affordable health care. It's unfortunate that that's become politicized and that people are ready to have a duel over it. But for us, there's really no downside to having access to affordable health care. I think reasonable people can disagree over what that access looks like. But for us as a health magazine and for a guiding force in people's lives, there's really no way around that for us. So we take really strong positions on the policy and on the values that align with what we're trying to get across. But as for the politics, as for the horse races, and as for the politicians themselves, we're happy to leave that to everybody else.
That was Richard Orman there speaking to Tone Edwards. And the special edition celebrating 30 years of the magazine is out now. Syndicated to over 2,600 newspapers around the world, Peanuts is certainly one of the most iconic comic strips. I am a big fan myself. To mark the 70th anniversary of the character Charlie Brown, Somerset House in London is hosting an exhibition called Good Grief, Charlie Brown, celebrating Snoopy and the enduring power of Peanuts. The exhibition features 80 original comic strips and interactive installations, including a Snoopy cinema. I've paid a visit to the exhibition here in London and spoke to Jean Shoes, the widow of Peanuts creator Charles M. Shoes and founder of the Charles M. Shoes Museum in California.
The museum is in Santa Rosa, California. It's very close to the studio where he worked for the past 25 years, and it's across the street from the ice arena that he and his first wife built, opened in 1969. And next to the Warm Puppy Cafe, where he had his breakfast and his lunch almost every day. So when we wanted to build the museum, we owned some property across the street from the ice arena, and we thought that would be the perfect place because now we have a Charles Schulz world there. People can eat breakfast of an English muffin, and then come over and see the museum and then go back and have a tuna sandwich. So they can participate in his world. Everyone called my husband Sparky. So Sparky passed away in 2000, but we had been discussing the museum for about 3 years. We had discussed all the elements of it together. We had chosen an architect, done the things we need to do to build an institution. So he was part of all the major decisions about it, but then he passed away before we had the groundbreaking. So we broke ground shortly after he died, and then 2 years later we opened. So we opened in 2002, so we've been going however many years that is, 16.
Oh, and it's fantastic, and I would love to visit this museum next time I'm in California.
Yes.
Tell us about the Somerset House exhibition. How did you contribute? How did they approach you and say, shall we have a discussion? What can...
Well, they said that they would like to come. I'm not the director of the museum, but I'm there almost every day and talk with the director every day. My family's British. I've been to England and London a number of times in the last 50 years. So I knew Somerset House, and she said they're coming and they want to do an exhibition, and they wanted to do it so quickly after they came to visit us. I thought, oh my gosh, it's probably not going to happen. And then all of a sudden it was happening. We have a very good exhibition staff, so they know all the material, and then they began collaborating with Claire about individual pieces. And Claire already, as she mentioned downstairs, already had the idea of collaborating with their current artists to see how the comic strip, which ended almost 20 years ago, still resonated with them. That's a part we rarely do. I mean, occasionally we have that, but not so much a modern artist who uses the Peanuts take off in a modern way. So I think people here are seeing something very special.
And again, the artist, we were even discussing before, there's even a Brazilian artist that did his own interpretation.
Yes.
And that just shows the global appeal of Peanuts. It's incredible.
Yes, the 7 global artists from around the world, Brazil, Japan, the United States, some in Europe, they're all contributing work for public art spaces. And so it is to show that Charlie Brown, that the characters still live with new artists.
And a question again about the global appeal. I mean, is Peanuts quite big in Japan, right? You were telling
me. It's very
me.
Big in Japan. I've wondered for 25 years, 30 years, what is it that they see in Peanuts? And I believe now, after talking to people and thinking about it and hearing people, it's the clean lines and the black and white, the simplicity of the strokes that appeal to them. It's very, very interesting because they bring out something that people using the character art on, say, t-shirts in the United States do it differently from Japan. So it's wonderful to see another culture, and quite a different culture, adopting Yeah.
I believe perhaps Charles was a big fan of newspapers because, you know, the Peanuts comic strip has been so many newspapers around the world, including my own country, Brazil. I grew up reading it while I was a child. What's the importance of that for Charles?
He always only wanted to be a comic strip artist. He wanted to have his own comic strip. He and his father loved the comics, and the comics were, remember, when he was a boy, comics were the television of the day. So he and his father grew up reading the Sunday comics, following the stories, wondering from one Sunday to a next what was going to happen next week. You know, you wait for the next edition. So that was the essence of his growing up. The comic strip dominated, and he wanted to be the comic strip artist. And so, of course, the newspapers were the way that was distributed. He honored the people who put it in their paper. He didn't want to offend people who read it. He thought the salesman worked hard to sell it to a newspaper. So he always wanted to be loyal to that audience. And I think that probably is something you don't find today. But of course, his survival depended upon that. But he also believed it.
Jean, a pleasure talking to you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The exhibition is on until the 3rd of March at Somerset House in London. If you're a big Peanuts fan, it's certainly worth it. And finally on the show, China's best-selling author Louis Cha passed away in Hong Kong in late October. The man, also known as his pen name Jin Yong, is thought to be one of the most respected writers in Chinese history. Not to mention, he also founded a successful daily newspaper, Ming Pao, in 1959. Louis Cha had lived his 94 years of life to the fullest when he was the first Hong Kong person to be greeted by the respected Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping in Beijing, and his kung fu fantasy series have earned him billions of Chinese readers around the world. But his work and influence is rather unknown in the West. To find out more about this larger-than-life character, we have got a well-known Hong Kong-based columnist, Chip Tsao, to shed some light. The man with a great deal of knowledge of Charles' work, as well as over 3 decades of friendship or mentorship with the cultural heavyweight. Our associate bureau chief in Hong Kong, Kurt Ling, went to have a chat with him.
Well, he's a bit of a combination of J.K. Rowling, Rupert Murdoch, to put it in a simple way, in general, right? He's written a series of very, very popular fantasy martial arts novels. And unfortunately, the values and ideology and styles of which could only largely be limited to the Chinese reading world. If you do any translation, I would say 80% would be lost. And at the same time, he's a newspaper tycoon. He's a big figure. He was very influential in China with his martial arts novels after the reform, but he was a strong voice during the colonial years in Hong Kong, when freedom of expression and freedom of speech were very much allowed. So he considered himself a rather lucky man. He once told many people, including myself, he made the right decision to escape China in that crucial year of 1949.
How should he be remembered and his legacy be remembered? Of course, primarily he's a writer, he's a popular writer, but he's also founded a very successful newspaper called Ming Pao. And it's very hard to neglect his success in running a successful media business, which is not easy compared to any other trade in that era. So how should he be remembered?
It's a grand question. He's a Citizen Kane. You remember that Orson Welles famous movie with flashback from different angles, from so many people's own experiences and memories. Citizen Kane was seen in a kaleidoscope of different personalities. He was a very successful newspaper boss, yet he was human. He had certain handicaps or weaknesses in his life, which he was aware. That's why his martial arts novels were fascinating. There are characters that echo Hamlet or King Lear, or Henry IV, even Julius Caesar from time to time. Because it's a series of martial arts, it's a long monologue of Q&A between himself. As he was struggling to become a rich man, as he was struggling to flourish with his newspaper business, he encountered pitfalls in life and a few very unhappy episodes, including with his family. And he was such a proud man. He would keep all these to himself. Right? And he was an avid reader. He loved reading so much. 4 hours at least every day, non-stop. He once told me if he had a choice between being sent to prison for 10 years, where he would be allowed to read all the books in the world freely, and if he was given 10 years free life, wining and dining, but no reading was allowed, he would rather like to choose to go to prison. And he was a Buddhist. He was a philosopher. I was amazed by such a wide collection of books on his bookshelves in his library and at his home, ranging from Ivanhoe to classical poetry of Tang Dynasty, from Ben-Hur even, to so many rare novels, right, in English or some even in French or Latin. God knows how much he could handle them. Amazing indeed.
I was fascinated by your anecdote with him and seeing his personal library in person. So could you share maybe one or two more anecdotes that you have had with him to sort of fascinate our listeners as well?
Well, he's an interesting man, right? He's an interesting man. We used to talk about a wide range of things, you know, Shakespeare. I mean, he gave me a few books on Shakespeare, which he purchased in Cambridge. He said, I was too busy to read all these, and you may keep them. He wasn't that serious a man as he appeared. Most of the time, he was not talkative at all, unless you were set face to face with him over a certain issue. With a crowd of friends and relatives, he preferred sitting there with a smile and listening to the noise that raised over the dining table. And if he overheard something interesting, he would just pass some footnote of brief commentary, and then that's it. When he wanted to get into serious business with you, he would just give you a call, invite you to his home over a glass of wet wine and some Parma ham, and he started his business. For example, in 1998, he wanted to launch a new weekly, and he asked me whether I would work with him again. And he went on and on telling me his plans or ambitions in quite meticulous details. I was really surprised. He was such a well-planned man, a man of thoughtfulness. But at that time, it was 1998, I dissuaded him. I said, well, look, we were at the threshold of a millennium. The world is getting into the 21st century. We are faced with unknown challenges. This is a digital age, internet, printing media is set to decline. And then after a few weeks, he called off the idea. I think it was sensible. He was rather old at that time, in his late 70s. He couldn't afford any Waterloo at that age and with a career like that.
Thanks, Kurt. Speaking there with Chip Tsao on the legacy of Louis Cha. Well, listeners, that's it for this week's show. Hope you've enjoyed. I mean, Man's Health, Peanuts, and the legacy of, you know, Louis Cha. What an interesting show. My thanks to our editor, Cassie Galpin. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me at fp@monocle.com. But before I go, as per tradition, a little song for you to enjoy. The interview with Richard from Man's Health inspired me to get a little physical. This is Olivia Newton-John.